Last February, the president sent a signal.
The drawdown of our military should send a clear signal that Iraq's future is now its own responsibility. The long-term success of the Iraqi nation will depend on decisions made by Iraq's leaders and the fortitude of the Iraqi people.
Yesterday's bloody signal from suicide bombers in Baghdad sorely tested the fortitude of those Iraqi people. Escalating chaos reveals vulnerable civilians, a vulnerable Iraqi government, and an Obama administration vulnerable on its policy in Iraq. Baghdad is suddenly a target-rich environment. But we knew that on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. A look at that target-rich environment in Baghdad in just a moment. It's Monday, October 26th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Coming up, can the U.S. pull its troops out of Iraq if the cities there are not safe? Also, why declaring a state of emergency is not necessarily an emergency? The East Coast is going to get an I-95 World Series. And how do you divide up your chores in your home? Forget mom and dad. Turns out daughters do more chores and get paid less often for it than their brothers do. Pay discrimination in the living room.
What about the ugly stepsisters, though? But let's get some clarity on Iraq. We're joined by Joost Hilterman, who's a deputy program director for the Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group. So Barack Obama says there's a clear message from the U.S. drawdown in Baghdad. What is the clear message sent by the perpetrators of this bloody bombing in Baghdad?
Good morning, John. Yeah, I think the message is that it's directed at the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, and it says, Mr. al-Maliki, we can get rid of you. Even if we cannot kill you, we can puncture your image as the man who brought peace to Iraq, and you will lose at the election.
And those elections are in January. We're going to talk about those elections and other details in Iraq with Joost Hilterman and someone else from Baghdad Live in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to hear this morning.
Our partner, the BBC, says the Taliban is claiming responsibility for a series of helicopter crashes in Afghanistan today. In total, 14 Americans are dead. The U.S. disputes the Taliban claims. It says in one of the incidents, two helicopters collided. President Obama meets with the security team again today to talk about the military strategy in Afghanistan. And that's as Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold says he'll build a coalition in the Senate to block any increase in troop levels in Afghanistan.
And as we've been reporting, rescue teams are still searching for survivors in the rubble of the deadliest suicide bombing in Iraq in 2 years. Officials say at least 155 people are dead. Back in the U.S., a man accused of profiting from Bernard Madoff's Ponzi scheme to the tune of $7 billion has been found dead in his home. Jeffrey Pickauer was 67 years old. In sports, the Yankees are headed to the World Series. They beat the L.A. Angels 5-2 to take the American League championship last night. The Yankees faced the Phillies in Game 1 of the World Series on Wednesday. Markets closed down slightly on Friday. The Dow opens next hour at 99.72. The S&P starts trading at 1080, and the Nasdaq begins at 21.54. Futures trading suggests a flat to positive opening when Wall Street gets underway in about an hour and a half from now. So have you thought about living without a credit card? What would it take? Would you even want to do so? Cynthia emails us. Not having a credit card is possible, of course, but extremely inconvenient. Just try to rent a car without one. I borrow money every month from Visa and pay it back promptly when the bill comes due. Then I cash in the air mileage earned every few years until the rules change. My credit card, she says, is a bargain. What do you think? At 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. We begin in Iraq. And, you know, even though we've been joined at the hip, the United States and Iraq, I think it's fair to say, since 2003.
Yes.
It's almost impossible to imagine what Iraqi civilians are going through, even though, you know, we haven't heard this ugly sound in quite a while. Ah. Crazy sounding. That's a shaky sort of audio from a cellular phone obtained by the Associated Press. That was the second of two suicide bombs that struck near the fortified Green Zone in Baghdad on Sunday. Death toll from these attacks keeps rising. It's about 150, more than 150 as of this morning. Tactics are familiar, of course. A first bomb followed by a second bomb as rescuers come to the scene, and the second bomb detonates, multiplying the number of casualties. And, of course, these bombings take place as Iraq is preparing for elections in January. We've already been told. Rod Nordland from the New York Times reported last week, I think on this program, that the withdrawal of U.S. troops might be paused or slowed down as a result of all this violence. Well, joining us is Jane Araf, Iraq correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and Middle East editor for Global Post. Jane, good morning there in Baghdad. Give us a sense of the scene of what's going on this morning.
Good morning, John. It's a typical Baghdad thing in that yesterday, if you had been there yesterday and I was walking around shortly after the blast, it was absolutely horrific. Literally blood flowing in the streets, mangled bodies, mangled cars. The scene today is very different because there is a tendency here to figuratively and literally sweep things away as quickly as possible. It looks relatively normal except for the blackened hulks of these buildings, which essentially have been destroyed. There isn't a whole lot of work going on in those ministries. And in the streets, the same feeling there has been since that huge August 19th bombing at two other ministries, that we're in for quite a dangerous period of time.
Is there clarity, Jane, as to who did this, who carried out these bombings? And were people expecting, a shoe to drop here for violence to escalate as the U.S. troops withdraw from the cities?
They are expecting it, and not just as U.S. troops withdraw, but as the elections come closer, as you mentioned. There is very rarely clarity here, but there's very often a consensus, and the consensus among the government certainly is that this was carried out by al-Qaeda in Iraq and planned, perhaps, by ex-Ba'athists. Those are the usual suspects that they turn to. This had very much the hallmarks of an al-Qaeda attack, the amount of explosives used, the coordination. When I talked to people in the streets yesterday, they were blaming it on other countries, blaming it on the U.S., and perhaps for the first time, blaming it on their own government. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is still quite popular in the streets, but they were saying that it was the government that has failed to protect them, along with the United States.
Now, Washington officials were quick to say that the Iraqi people are opposed to these kinds of attacks and can weather the storm and move forward. Is that what you're hearing on the streets?
That's a really interesting view, and it's a little bit cynical, isn't it? Because, yes, of course, they can weather the attacks. They can move forward. They don't really have a choice. It's one step forward, two steps back many times. We're talking about a government that was essentially paralyzed to begin with. There are not a whole lot of decisions being made here. There are not a lot of functioning ministries the way they think they are, the way that we tend to think they are. And the U.S. is very much facing a deadline. It's very worried about that deadline, which is why we see these repeated statements that Parliament must pass an election law.
You're referring to the 2010.
There are a lot of things that have to happen.
The 2010 deadline you're referring to for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Jane Araf, the Iraq correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Middle East editor for Global Post, who joined us from Baghdad. Jane, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So the question for regional diplomats and policymakers in Washington and Iraq is, does more of this... Again, that's the sound from those twin suicide bombings in Baghdad yesterday. Does more of that complicate Iraq's plans for elections next January? Does it inflame divisions between central Iraq and northern Kurdistan, for instance, or between Sunni and Shiite factions? Does it slow down the pace of the U.S. withdrawal of troops? Senator John McCain doesn't think so.
It's extremists trying to ignite sectarian violence is what's going on. But it's they've still got a ways to go, but it's not going to require any delay in withdrawal of U.S. troops.
We're here again with Joost Hilterman, Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group. Joost, you just heard Jane Araf suggesting that the Iraqi people, no matter what American policymakers may say about them being willing to weather the storm, have absolutely no choice. Does the U.S. government have a choice in slowing down the withdrawal of troops here in the face of these bombings?
Well, I think that the domestic pressures in the United States are such that it would be very difficult for President Obama to slow down the troop withdrawals. But I think at the same time that it should be given some consideration, not to stop the withdrawals, but to reconsider the timetable, because security remains unstable, and more importantly, we're about to face a major political crisis in Iraq around the elections and the formation of a new government.
Now, Jane Araf was saying that Nouri al-Maliki is popular on the streets of Baghdad and in Iraq. If the election were held today, do you think he would win?
I think he would have a good chance, but his alliance is not the only one running, obviously. He faces some formidable foes. So he may end up being the largest group and being designated to form the new government, but he certainly would have trouble forming a government because he must find other groups to ally himself with.
And where are the fractures then? Because it's a little puzzling to me what the threshold point is for the people who are carrying out these attacks. Do they want the elections to be delayed? Do they want Iraq to just sort of fall apart? Do they want to bring down Maliki? Or do they just want to make delays and then for propaganda purposes say, hey, look what we did?
Well, I think it's the latter point, mostly. I think they want to disrupt the political process. They want to puncture Mr. Maliki's image as the man who brought peace to Iraq, but it's not directed at Maliki specifically. They would do it against anyone leading the government today. So they want to make sure that everybody knows that they're still around and that their demands are not being heard and being answered.
Is this? I assume this is a completely separate fight from what's going on inside the parliament, where they can't agree on number one, votes in Kurdish territories, but also on whether or not people can vote by party and whether they have to list individual candidates. That's a separate issue.
It is a separate issue. It is a separate issue. But I would say that Mr. Maliki's opponents, who are plentiful and who are, of course, also in the parliament, certainly would take advantage of these bombings, even though they would never come out and say that. And already they have done it to say that Mr. Maliki is not a leader who can bring security to Iraq. And so all of these games start overlapping and intertwining.
Well, Joost Hilterman, Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group. He's speaking to us from Washington, D.C. You know, Celeste raises an interesting point there. As we've seen in Afghanistan, the Taliban, which has attacked institutions inside Afghanistan, prefers to remain outside of the political process.
Right.
If these are Ba'athists in Iraq who are responsible for this disruption, are they insisting on staying outside the political process? We'll call for a boycott of elections, or is there some deal that can be negotiated to bring them into the government in some way?
I think they need to be marginalized. These are a fairly small group, but very powerful, because they have their hands on powerful explosives, as we saw,
sure.
Because there is a lot of unsecured material still from 2003, from the war. And so they can do this. But the key is the remainder of the Sunni community, or the majority of the Sunni community, and where their loyalty lies. And these bombs, in a way, are also aimed at telling these people there's no point in joining this Shiite government, and they will never govern Iraq and provide protection for everyone, including for you. And so you should be with us.
All right, then that raises another point, and that is the threshold here to re-engage and re-inflame the sectarian violence that was so destabilizing in 2004 and 2005 in Iraq between Sunnis and Shia? I mean, Al-Qaeda and the Ba'athists are Sunni, but can they really sort of trigger something much broader?
I doubt very much that they at this point would be able to trigger sectarian violence. That is not really it may be part of the aim, but it's not a realistic aim. What is more realistic is to generally disrupt the political process and to show to everyone that Iraq cannot be governed. And that therefore, because there's a notion that the Shiites are incapable of governing, that it's time to bring the Sunnis back to power because they have always governed Iraq.
All right. The U.S. is backing Nouri al-Maliki and is backing this election process. From your perspective, Joost Hilterman, what is the U.S. government getting wrong in Iraq based on this attack?
Well, I think what they're getting wrong is the idea that they can leave without leaving behind something that is sustainable. What they need to do is to continue to build up Iraqi forces, and they need, most importantly, to mediate a set of political deals between the Iraqi actors on the disputed territories in the north, which are claimed by the Kurds, and on power sharing, also on how oil is managed and the
Indeed.
Revenues of oil sales are shared.
Well, familiar issues, familiar challenges that go back to 2003 for both the Iraqi government and the U.S. government. Joost Hilterman is Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group. He joined us from Washington, talking about how those challenges change or get more difficult in the wake of the twin suicide bombings that killed more than 150 people in Baghdad yesterday.
And now for some takeouts on stories we're following this week, and we are going to start with Go-Go Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
So when is an emergency not an emergency, right? That's the question today. President
right.
Obama declared swine flu a national emergency, but we aren't having a serious influx of cases in hospitals. It isn't actually an urgent thing. This is him, he says, preparing to give hospitals the right to move forward with preparedness techniques, right?
Well, the number of cases is way up. There's no doubt about that. You know, flu cases surge every single year because we have a
right,
normal
this
flu
time.
Season. And it's very front-loaded this year because of H1N1, and H1N1 seems to have peaked not peaked, but be on the rise much earlier than normal flu. So normally hospitals are prepared for lots of flu cases. And this year, they're not overwhelmed, but they're seeing a lot more. And there is a danger they could become overwhelmed. But so this emergency declaration, in administrative terms, even though it sounds quite stark, maybe not so much.
But you know, to a certain extent, is it possible that this is just him covering his political hiney because there's so much disappointment that they didn't get all the doses out of the vaccine and people feel like the government wasn't prepared, the government isn't doing what they need to do, and then suddenly President Obama declares it a national emergency?
I tend to think that that's unlikely, and here's why. If you listen to hospital administrators, frontline ER doctors and infectious disease people, these types of waivers that are allowed under this emergency declaration really do help them in very sort of real logistical ways. It does things like, you know, when people show up at a hospital under the law, the hospital is not allowed to transport them to another site. Or isolate them without a lot of paperwork. And meeting a lot of federal regulations. This gives relief from that. So if they need to set up an H1N1 ward in a separate area, where, by the way, isolation is very important from a public health perspective, this allows them to do it, where you can just take people and move them over. Under law, by the way, doctors can't discuss a patient's health care or their disease if other people are close enough to listen. That can violate privacy regulations.
That's the HIPAA regulations, right?
That's a lot of that is HIPAA. This also waives that. So if you're in an H1N1 ward and you say, Mr. Hockenberry, we think you're infected, you can actually say that behind a curtain where somebody else might hear. It's things as specific as that you need to do if your hospital
right.
does get overwhelmed. And for the docs and the nurses on the scene,
okay,
Todd
really Zwillick is the Takeaways Washington correspondent. The answer there is emergency is not an emergency, I guess, when it involves swine flu.
Well, it's an emergency in the business world when your paycheck shrinks. Dan Gross joins us now, senior editor at Newsweek and contributor at Slate.com, to talk about how this week, because of what Ken Feinberg, President Obama's so-called pay czar, has been doing, this week some checks on Wall Street are actually going to shrink. Dan, whose checks are shrinking and by how much?
Well, the people who work at seven large financial institutions that are not only part of the TARP, but really big parts of the TARP and got extra help. We're talking Citigroup, Bank of America, AIG, some of the auto lending companies. These are ones that didn't just, you know, get some money last October, but then got additional help. And at those, the pay czar, Ken Feinberg, last week came out and said, we're going to cut pay or limit pay for the top 25 earning executives at these companies. No one is going to make more than $200,000 in cash. The stock components of the award will, you know, vest in several years rather than immediately. At one level, this is highly symbolic because these firms, these that are wards of the state, that are, you know, if they didn't have all this government support, wouldn't be paying anything.
Right. Well, what's this going to look like on their paychecks? Any idea? I mean, there's going to be FICA, right? There's going to be like federal withholding, and then there's going to be, and because we hate you so much, we're taking this out, right?
Right. There's going to be a big scarlet W for extra withholding.
And it will be called extra withholding.
No, I don't think it'll be called extra withholding. Keep in mind that at these companies, compensation basically comes in the form of a bonus. And for the highest earners, they may have a salary throughout the year of, say, $200,000, you know, which for most of us, that's a good year's work. For them, that's what they get paid just to sort of show up
right.
Until they get their bonus at the end of the year in December or January, which is frequently in the millions. And that's what they really consider their payday. That's
right.
the component
right.
we're talking about.
All right. Very, very quickly. What does this do in the executive lunchroom? If you got your paycheck shrunk, are you someone with more status or less status this week?
I would say you are someone with a whole lot less status. And actually, you know, if you are still at one of these companies, you have a lot less status compared with if you're at Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley.
I see.
We've seen financial services bifurcate. Those who have been able to pay back the TARP money, get on with their business, and those who can't.
And Dan has written a column on this on executive pay for Newsweek.com. Ever tried to live without a credit card, Dan?
Maybe when I was 17.
You've grown up since then, and you've done so well for yourself. Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek and contributor at TheSlate.com.
Our last takeout comes from our listeners. We talked about shortages of the swine flu vaccine with people like Allison Prangy in Madison, Wisconsin. Her 4-year-old daughter has asthma, and she hasn't been able to get the H1 vaccine for her daughter. Here's what she told us last week.
I'm very concerned. I'm just a concerned mom that wants to protect my daughter, and we know that this option is out there.
But our listeners are always reaching out with their own stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
This is Kevin Kennedy in Norman, Oklahoma. I heard this story with the woman in Wisconsin. I don't know if this will make her feel any better, but my son, who has asthma and is 5 years old, contracted the disease last week. We got him into the doctor. The day he presented symptoms, they gave him Tamiflu. It was H1N1. And 5 days later, he was fine. So it would seem that if you can get them in quickly, that the available medication is effective. So all is not lost if you can't get the H1N1 vaccine.
And of course, vaccinations and healthcare issues of all kinds create all sorts of debates. And we heard from one respondent last week.
One of the issues with the new H1N1 viral vaccine is that the multi-dose units contain the preservative dimerosal, which is a mercury preservative. Now, the issue with that is, of course, autism.
The issue is autism, but science has not been able to prove that contaminants or preservatives in vaccines cause autism in any way. But Brooklyn Mom and Michelangelo write that on our website. But here's what another one of you said.
My name is Stephanie. I was going to give my kids the swine flu vaccine, and then I saw that Thermosol was a part of the multiple shot, and I'm scared about Thermosol. Even though they say there's no connection with autism and studies don't show that, I'm still not convinced.
And it's Thimerosal. Other listeners are weighing in on that as well.
This is Di. I live in New Jersey. I'm 66 years old, and I was able to get the H1N1 vaccine by participating in a clinical study. I got it earlier this week. Too bad there is no vaccine against believing stupid propaganda.
Well, keep the insults to a minimum, but tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're always interested in your comments at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, we'll talk about some of the most important stories of the week in the agenda. First, some of the news stories are following at 32 minutes after the hour. In Afghanistan, it's been one of the deadliest days of the war for U.S. troops. A series of helicopter crashes killed 14 Americans. Our partner, the BBC, reports the Taliban is claiming responsibility for the crashes. The U.S. military denies that claim. We'll talk more about that story in a few minutes in our agenda segment. President Obama will be taking on the strategy in Afghanistan when he meets with his national security advisors later this morning. After the meeting, he heads to a Florida naval base where he'll address service members, and later he'll be raising money for Democrats. And one of America's NATO partners, Turkey, has accused the West of treating Iran unfairly. It says it isn't fair to criticize Iran for having a nuclear program when Western countries have large nuclear infrastructures.
Back home, a friend of Bernie Madoff has been found dead at his home. Jeffrey Pickauer is accused of making $7 billion from Madoff's Ponzi scheme. The price of gas is up for the first time since July. The average price on a gallon of unleaded is $2.66, a jump of nearly 18 cents in the past 2 weeks. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going on?
It's Monday. That means it's time to check out what's on the agenda for this week. Joining us today is Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. But first, we spoke earlier to Charles Haviland. He's the BBC correspondent in Kabul. Tragic news today. The U.S. military says 14 Americans died in a series of helicopter crashes this morning in Afghanistan. The Taliban is claiming they shot at least one of the helicopters out of the sky. So, Charles, we asked Charles for the latest on those crashes.
There are unconfirmed reports that the Taliban have indeed claimed to have been behind, I think, both of these helicopter incidents. They both were reported by the NATO-led force here at different times. And as you have been saying, they have reported a large number of American casualties specifically. In the first incident, said to have been a mid-air collision, four American service members were reported to have been killed, and that was in the south of Afghanistan. And the other incident that was reported was in the west, a traditionally less troubled part of the country, but one where in patches Taliban activity has been increasing. And this one was even more deadly. It was said that seven U.S. troops and three U.S. civilians were killed. And not only that, about 25, 26 civilians, service people and civilians, both American and Afghan, were reported to have been injured.
Wow.
In the second crash, though, the army or the military is saying that that was a collision of two helicopters in the southern part of Afghanistan. Do we have any confirmation on that?
The sudden crash, the collision of two helicopters killing four American service people. The only report we had for several hours was that one from the US military speaking within the NATO umbrella, if you like. But now, as I say, we do have some agency reports that the Taliban are claiming to have been behind both of the helicopter incidents, both the mid-air collision and the later one with the higher death toll.
Does this kind of violence, I assume it's going to make it more difficult for those who are preparing for the runoff election on November 7th?
Well, I think it's a reminder of the difficulties this country faces. The fact is that the whole election episode, if you like, starting from the campaigns and then the first round of the presidential voting in August, and then the dragging on for weeks with the allegations of fraud surfacing, and now the decision to hold a second round. This is all, if you like, a big political distraction, some people would say, from the real business, which is trying to actually quell the insurgency in Afghanistan. It's a reminder that this insurgency is actually growing in strength. And we've got to be aware that this year has seen more of the foreign service people dying in this country than any other year since the invasion, which precipitated the fall of the Taliban in 2001.
Okay, Charles Howland is a correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joined us from Kabul. So we turn now to Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. And Marcus, it appears we have Chuck Schumer saying what a couple weeks ago would have been a very surprising thing.
I think we're very close to getting the 60 votes we need to move forward. And my guess is that the public option level playing field with the state opt-out will be in the bill.
That's Chuck Schumer on Meet the Press yesterday. He says they're getting close to 60 votes on the public option. Do you think he's right?
Yeah, I think he is right. There's been an extraordinary change, Les, as you say. Just a few weeks ago, we were all saying the public option is dead. There's no way there's going to be a government plan that will compete with private insurers to insure Americans for their health care. And then suddenly it's back. It's a resurrection of the public plan.
Maybe it never died. Like just you know, call me wacky, you know, hey?
Well, would you be saying down at the media somehow over...
Just call me kind of wacky,
ignore that guy over there.
The Democrats certainly have a new backbone on this health care deal, and it's interesting because... A lot of it has to do with shifting poll numbers that show more Americans in favor of it than the majority, in fact. And we also see that might have something to do with the fact that right about now, most of us are filling out our health care options for next year, those of us who are employer plans, which is the majority of Americans. And we're seeing massive increases in premiums. So people who are lucky enough to have jobs still and who may even be getting raises will have those raises mostly eliminated by the increase in their health care premiums.
Inklings from any Republicans who may go for the public option?
Well, no, not yet. It's interesting. What we are seeing is however, a change on the part of Olympia Snowe.
Yeah, they bought her vote with that bank deal that Obama announced late last week, it sounds like.
Well, you know, she would say that it's much bigger than that. She would say she does want health care reform, she would say. And she would say that what she has changed her opinion on is a trigger. The option, you could have a trigger where if you have a monopoly by one or two insurers in a certain market, say the state of Maine, where she's from, where there is this monopoly problem, then there would be a trigger that would kick in a government option that would be applicable just there. Now, the smartest thing about this, I think, is the fact that the Democrats are saying, well, states can choose to opt out now. So there'll be a government option, and it's states that choose not to allow that to compete in their states.
So they're kind of putting that decision back on their states. So since John mentioned the bank thing, let's talk a little bit about that. The Obama administration is supposed to announce a bill today that'll give it the power to dismantle unhealthy banks. So is this the response to the idea that some banks are too large to fail?
This is their attempted response. The biggest surprise of the cataclysm in capitalism that we had in the last year is the fact that we said this was the worst thing since the Great Depression, and yet there's been very little reform that's taken place since then. We're back to pretty much where we were before, only with that actually now we have fewer institutions that are even more powerful because there are fewer of them.
Because they all absorbed one another, right? Are they just going back to Glass-Steagall and separating out the trading
from the old regulatory regime?
Some are saying they should. This administration is not going to do that. Mm-hmm. They're very explicit. They're not going to go that far. They don't think they have to go that far. They think they can actually have living wills, in essence, for corporations. The corporations will mostly draw up themselves of how to unwind them if they get into real trouble.
But how do you prevent a bank from getting too big to fail? Except, we noticed it's too big to fail. Yeah.
Well, Paul Volcker, this is what Mervyn King, the leading British regulator, have been saying. They've been saying you have to actually break them up now before they're too big to fail. It's not clear. It's certain the administration will not go that far. It's not clear that the plan they're going to roll out this week will be enough.
No, we'll see how far the administration will go. Marcus Mabry, thank you so much. The international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. Coming up, we're going to talk about families as we do every Monday. And the news is that one kind of child is doing more chores and less likely to get paid than the other kind. I'm calling unfair. We're going to talk about that later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
I just noticed when it was 8 o'clock and our flight hadn't landed and we didn't hear anything over the broadcast that we were descending yet, we were started to question it. And then about a half hour later, finally, there was an announcement made.
One more hit on that strange case of Northwest Airlines Flight 188, which, as that passenger describes, overshot Minneapolis Airport, lost contact with air traffic controllers for over an hour on Thursday. Imagine having about an hour or more to kill on an airplane. Hmm? It's a problem for all
well,
of us air travelers.
Yeah,
how many Sudokus could you do?
Exactly.
How many?
I don't do Sudokus, but I can do at least a couple New York Times crosswords.
We figured with our unscientific research over the weekend that you could accomplish pretty reading 10 or more issues of People magazine or Us Weekly, but you could not get through The Economist. But question is, when there are periods of time, downtime, and pilots have them on airliners, what do you do with that time? Ben Berman is an airline pilot, former chief of major investigations at the NTSB. This is, of course, a serious story, Ben, Northwest Airlines Flight 188. There's no consensus on what happened during that period of time when the pilots were out of contact. But is it possible that pilots would use downtime in the course of a normal flight, and planes are very, very automated these days, to try to get some sleep, as some have theorized? Again, the pilots deny that they were asleep at all.
Hello, John and Celeste. How you doing? There's a lot of downtime, in a sense, when a plane's in cruising flight. Not that much is happening, but it isn't really downtime. You're always monitoring your position and monitoring the amount of fuel you have left, and so there's an amount of activity that's going on. Having said that, fatigue is a major problem in flying, and it's been recommended by NASA for many, many years that pilots use some of that lower activity time to take a quick nap, take a 25 to 30-minute nap, which will give you the alertness you need to make a safe landing downline. So it's a pretty good idea, actually.
And as alarming as power naps in flight sounds maybe to passengers, the implicit suggestion here is that there is this lower activity time means it's actually hard to stay awake in some of the boring moments of a flight when you're cruising at 37,000 feet and the pilot's under its own power.
Well, it can be hard to stay awake if you're in a fatigued state. And we don't know if these pilots of the Northwest flight were fatigued.
No, indeed.
It turns out that they hadn't been on duty all that long at the time of the incident. They had just come off a rest period. So the investigators that are looking into the case are going to evaluate their fatigue, and the pilots are going to say more about it to the investigators. But having said that, if you're in a fatigue state or if you're projecting you're going to be fatigued, 8 hours later when you land, if you're on a long flight, it can be the best thing to do to take a rest. The rest is a controlled rest, a controlled nap.
Well, let's talk controlled. How do you control? We got less than a minute. How do you control, Ben Berman, a power nap in a flight situation? I mean, do you tell air traffic control, I'm going down for 20 minutes, so wake me up in 20?
Well, the key to it is that it's coordinated between the two pilots. They decide who's going to be the one napping, who's going to be the one staying alert. It may be coordinated with the flight attendants. There may be alarms set. It's done in a controlled way, the whole idea being you avoid having both pilots be asleep at the same time. It's a good idea. It's not a great idea. The best idea is to have pilots be well-rested and have the right kind of rest rules and rest regulations that keep
controlled,
everybody rested on the deck.
Controlled naps are probably better than uncontrolled naps. Ben Berman is an airline pilot, former chief of major investigations of the National Transportation Safety Board, talking about Northwest Airlines Flight 188 and naps are not, at least, the cause of that being out of touch of air traffic control, according to the pilots. Thank you, Ben.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, who does the chores in your house? Supposedly, studies show boys are getting away with being messier and yet still somehow making more money than the girls. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says it's unfortunate that supplies of the H1N1 vaccine are not widely available. But speaking on national television this morning, she says eventually there will be enough of the vaccine to go around. This morning, Turkey has accused the West of treating Iran unfairly. Turkey says it's not fair that that those who accused Iran of pursuing nuclear weapons had strong nuclear infrastructures themselves. Scott Ritter, speaking on The Takeaway this morning, said the Turkish government is making a good point.
There's an anti-Iran policy in place in the United States and elsewhere. Regardless of what President Obama says about the need to engage, he inherited a policy objective of regime change, and many aspects of that policy are in place.
Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector, speaking to us earlier.
In Afghanistan, NATO is denying Taliban claims that it was involved in today's helicopter crashes that killed 14 Americans. NATO says in one of the incidents, two helicopters collided. Back in the U.S., at the box office, it was a paranormal horror weekend.
Somebody's here. I feel it breathing on me.
Footsteps in, but there's no footsteps out.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. That's what Hollywood executives are saying. The low-budget horror flick, $15K it took to make Paranormal Activity, took in $22 million. Saw 6 came in second, kind of a Halloween thing. Looking ahead, it's set. The Yankees face the Phillies in the World Series on Wednesday. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Roll out of the shadows and find that adventure.
It's Monday. That means it's time to talk about family on The Takeaway. And does anyone recognize this particular home scene?
This is disgusting. If you don't like it, then don't eat it. I don't even know what the hell it is. It's spaghetti with Thousand Island dressing. God, that is so gross! Well, maybe if you hadn't dumped the laundry and the vacuuming on me, I would have had time to plan a more exciting menu. Hey, I have been running around all day, picking DJ up from school, taking him to get shoes, going to the supermarket. And when I get home, I expect a decent meal on the table.
Okay, so maybe it's not as extreme as it is in Roseanne's home, where they're vacuuming, cleaning, and making spaghetti with Thousand Island dressing. But joining us now is a Takeaway contributor, Lisa Belkin, who writes the parenting and family blog Motherload for our partner, The New York Times. It may not be that extreme, Lisa, but it does look like kids are doing more of a larger percentage of the chores around the house, right?
Yeah, a really interesting study. For years, people have been telling us, you know, parents are working longer. Both parents are working. Women are still doing the same ratio of housework to men, and yet things sort of seem to be getting done. And at Montclair State University, they found a wrinkle in the data, which says that, yeah, who's doing more of the work at home? It's the kids. Kids have more chores.
It's almost as though the parents lost their jobs, came home, saw that the house was a mess, and said, kids, get to work.
Well, yeah, a la Roseanne, maybe. I find it interesting that the more a father works, for every hour a father works, a child does statistically 2 minutes more in chores a week.
Huh.
And the more a mother works, though, there's no change.
They stay the same.
They stay the same. So it's still the skewed ratio between men and women.
Meaning,
women still
of course,
do two times as much as men. And now
right.
When the men need to work more, it's the kids who are taking up the slack.
This isn't the only thing that they found in this, though. And to talk about the second part of that study, we have Bob
Elston.
The
thing that's giving you hives.
Yeah, exactly. Bob Elston is a father of 4 kids, all under the age of 12. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
You have 3 boys and 1 girl, and the part of this that, as I said, gives me a rash is the part where it says that girls do more chores than boys and get paid less for it. So tell us, you have 3 boys and 1 girl, all under the age of 12. Explain to us, in your household, how do the chores stack up?
Well, I don't think that there's any reason why my daughter would do any more than her brothers. I mean, our vacuum cleaner doesn't really care if it's a boy's hand on the handle or a girl's handle.
You got one of those.
Pushing the thing around. Yeah.
And you pay them all equally.
Pay them all equally. Well, I wouldn't want to hear it from her if I paid them unequally and then had to explain to her why she was getting less.
And yet, Lisa Belkin, we have this showing that girls do 73.3% of the girls say they have assigned chores. Only 65% of boys say they do, and the girls get paid less, right, Lisa?
Right. They are 15% less likely to be paid. I don't know that we have numbers on exactly what the going rate is per chore in the United States right now, but they are 15% less likely to be paid. And the kind of chores they're doing seem to base on gender lines.
What do you mean?
After all these years of telling boys and girls that they were the same, the boys are still mowing the lawn and the girls are still doing the dishes, by broad generalization, not in any necessarily given household. But that's what they're reporting when researchers ask them.
Is there any data of how this happens within families where there are girls and boys? I mean, does this disparity sort of work publicly within a family without, like, exploding it?
Not the data that we see or have in front of us. What is interesting is that kids notice unfairness. A lot of these numbers came from a Highlights for Children study. And what the researchers there noted was, okay, we get 60,000 letters here at Highlights every year from kids, and a good number of them are complaining about unfairness.
Well, you heard,
they see it, they recognize it.
You heard Bob say that his daughter would kick up a fuss if he treated his sons differently than he treated his daughter, right? That's what you said?
Yeah, right. I mean, if you treat your kids unfairly, I'm sure they're going to notice. And then you actually have to come up with a reason why you're doing it, and then you're on a slippery slope that I wouldn't want to be on.
But your daughter has an extra way to make money. She also babysits, right? Is she the oldest?
She's 10 years old. She's in the middle. I pay my kids, or I give my kids an allowance of $5 a week, but my daughter has the potential to make more by babysitting her little 2-year-old brother so that I can take the 11-year-old and the 8-year-old to football practice. But then the roles are reversed, and one of the brothers has to babysit their little brother so that I can take my daughter to soccer practice.
And so, does he get paid for that, too?
Uh-huh, sure.
Okay. So, Lisa, you know, I found it interesting. There was a comment from a sociologist in the article about this study saying, you know, we thought this would all even out, that as a generation or two of women got into jobs and started taking management positions even in their work, that all of these disparities at home would disappear.
Yeah, we thought the disparities between the adults would disappear too. And interestingly, they're remarkably sticky.
The same,
We have the same ratio of work at home between men and women that we had 50 years ago. The amount of housework women do is the same compared to the amount of housework men do as 50 years ago. Now, everyone's doing less, but in proportion, that hasn't changed.
So what do we do? I mean, obviously, these exact same disparities that men and women are finding as adults in both their workplace and at home, they're passing on to their children.
Yeah, what do we do?
Is that because women don't mind?
I don't think it's that women don't mind. I think it's that none of us think about it. And I think that that's the answer, is think about it. If you are automatically telling your daughter to wash the dishes and sending your son out to mow the lawn, then you're doing it without thinking. And, well, he's stronger. He can push it better. And, you know, she's standing here, so she can wash the dishes. So, and yet you're setting an example. You're creating a trend.
Bob, do you deliberately decide to split the chores between genders on mowing the lawn versus babysitting?
No, I think we probably divide up our chores more based on age. You know, we start them early with chores, and as they get better and more mature, they can do heavier work. So that's how we split it up.
John, you're opposite of Bob. You have the three girls and the one boy. So who do your kids do chores?
With a little prompting, yes, they do tons and tons of chores. But as to how it shakes out in terms of equity, if I open my mouth, I will hear about it. So I'll take some data tonight when I get home and let you know.
Let's get some data on that.
Think.
Lisa Velkin is a takeaway contributor and author of the family and parenting blog Motherload at our partner, the New York Times. Bob Elston is a father of four kids in Virginia.
Do your daughters do different chores than your sons, and do you pay them differently? We're interested to hear how this all plays out in your own home.
This is Mike from Wayne, New Jersey. First, let me say, growing up, my sister would probably kill me, but I did many more chores than she did, I think. And in my household, I have three girls, and I will tell you that they're all different by personality, not by gender. My oldest daughter doesn't want anything to do with outside chores. My middle daughter is happy doing outside chores, and one likes doing dishes, one likes vacuuming, one likes folding clothes. It's all different.
You know, I think that's close to how it would shake out in my house as well. Anita tweets says, I always had to clear out the dishwasher. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're also talking about the power of plastic, you know, that stuff in your wallet. Have you thought about living without a credit card? What would it take? How would you change your life? Would you even want to live without credit cards?
I would, and I do. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
We'll be right back. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Women are paying 50% more for the same health care plan in some states.
I'm hoping my testimony before the Senate is going to really encourage other women to come out and let America know what's happening to them with the individual insurance companies.
And women are going to the U.S. Senate to ask for insurance equality. Independent women across America, why should you pay more for your health care than your brothers and fathers? Is it good business or is it just baloney? You decide on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 26th. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Also on the program, we assess the national emergency of H1N1 flu. Also, preventing too big to fail without encouraging failure of banks. And how inspectable is Iran going to be as we learn more about its nuclear program? And finally, living without credit cards. By choice or not, we learn once again, it can be done.
But first, Judy Waxman joins us. Judy is from the National Women's Law Center. Judy, a new report from your group seems to say that in many states, being a woman is a pre-existing condition. Is that true?
That is true. All over the country, we did a study that showed that women do pay more than men in almost all states for the exact same plan, and it doesn't include maternity care.
Well, okay, we're going to be talking more about that for sure with Judy Waxman. But first, everything else you need to know in the news this morning.
And in the headlines, Health and Human Services Secretary Catherine Sebelius says it's unfortunate that the H1N1 vaccine is not widely available, but she says eventually there will be enough to go around. More about that in just a moment. In Afghanistan, NATO is denying Taliban claims that it was involved in today's helicopter crashes that killed 14 Americans. NATO says in one of the incidents, two helicopters collided. Staying in the region, the death toll from the deadliest attack in Iraq in more than 2 years climbed to 155 today. Rescuers are still searching for survivors, and funerals for the dead were held across Baghdad.
Back in the U.S., a friend of Bernie Madoff has been found dead at his home. Jeffrey Picower was accused of making $7 billion from Madoff's Ponzi scheme. And in sports, the Yankees are headed to the World Series. They beat the L.A. Angels 5-2 to take the American League championship last night.
You're not smiling while you say that.
Did you expect me to smile?
I didn't. I thought maybe, but no.
No.
The Yankees
are going to face the Phillies. The poor Angels?
Poor Angels.
Yes, poor Angels. Actually,
I'm smiling.
Poor guys. the Yankees and then face the Phillies in game one of the World Series on Wednesday. The Angels did great.
There's no reason for them to feel bad.
They did great.
They should feel really good about themselves.
Hey!
Sorry. It's uncalled for.
Markets closed slightly down on Friday. The Dow opens this hour at 99.72. The S&P starts trade at 1080, and the NASDAQ is going to begin at 21.54. So, talking about plastic, credit cards in your wallet. I mean, some people have tons of them. Some people have multiple credit cards. I'm not one of them. And the question for you is, would you live without a credit card? What would it take to get you to give up your plastic? And would you even want to do that? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. John, would you ever give up the credit cards?
Well, the recession, I think, has changed a lot of people's behavior. I think we used to have way more credit cards than we have now. I think we live off a debit card, so we're cash flow people, not credit card people, but it's different for everybody.
And, you know, debit cards don't count because that's actually cash. That's real cash backed up. You're not over leveraging. There's cash in your account.
We do have a mortgage, though.
Yeah. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. So, John, how many times would you estimate you go to the doctor every year?
Two or three times a year.
See, that's pretty much the same as I do. My kid goes more often, but how about your wife? She's pregnant, so...
Well, yeah, she goes once a week. Yeah,
right.
She goes once
but
a week.
But she's
now,
pregnant.
Now she's once a week. Yeah, she's been going once a month, once a week since April.
So the question is here, if we have equal health care plans, should I pay more than you? My answer is no. I don't think I should. Judy Waxman is vice president of the National Women's Law Center. She joins us from D.C. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning.
Your National Women's Law Center released a report called Still Nowhere to Turn, and the findings in this are very sobering. I mean, you found that around the world, as you said earlier, being a woman is a pre-existing condition. Women are paying more for equal health care plans, right?
Yep. Yes, that's true. And the plans we looked at did not include maternity care. It was the same exact coverage. Women paid more in the vast majority of the time.
How does that work? It says here that insurance companies are charging women 10 to 50% more. In Arkansas, women are paying 50% more for identical plans. How does that work? Are these through employers that they're actually taking out more in premiums? Are they charging the employers more for their female employees?
Good question. No, the plans we looked at were actually the ones that we say are in the individual market, the kind when you have to go out on your own and you go online and you figure out what plans are available for you. That's what our study looked at, because that's the information we could readily get. But it is true that companies are charged more according to how many women they have. Employees don't see it because it's federal law that the company's not allowed to charge the man or the
right.
woman a different rate. But, in fact, the insurance company is charging the company more according to how many women are employed.
Okay, I want you to listen to this response from a listener named Peggy Robinson, who was denied insurance by the Golden Rule Insurance Company in Colorado.
If they could have given me a plan, they would have put a C-section rider on it, meaning if I were to have another C-section, they wouldn't cover it. Well, Colorado doesn't allow that, so therefore they couldn't offer me a plan at all. And their solution to this was, because we can't offer you a C-section rider, if you will get sterilized, that would be one way that we would cover you.
This is a woman who had a C-section. They wouldn't give her an insurance plan because they weren't allowed by state law to put a C-section rider on it, and they suggested she get sterilized.
Unbelievable.
Well, I guess, Judy, the question is broadly, and that's a horrible story. Actuarially speaking, is there any justification for increased
right.
payment of premiums by women under any sort of circumstances? You say your study excluded for maternity, but I'm wondering if there's another argument here that we're missing.
Well, insurance companies do say that. They say that women use services more. But I would say to that that not every woman, as you already demonstrated, do go to the doctor more than every other man. It's kind of a stereotype. And when you look at the premiums as we did all over the country, it looks so arbitrary. You can't, every state is different, and plans within states when we compared them were different. So it's very hard to see that it's based on anything scientific.
You know, possibly relates to the civil rights cases we had in the 50s and 60s, when there was always reports of people of different races being charged different costs for their health care plans just based on their race. And the insurance companies at those times said that there were differences in health care usage for different races, right?
Well, the fact is we don't charge different premiums for people of different races anymore. And it's time that we didn't charge different rates for gender. It's also time we got rid of all pre-existing conditions and charging people more just because they happen to have a particular physical issue. Insurance is supposed to cover us all for everything that we have, and these are the kinds of things that insurance companies use to figure out ways to make more profit, and it's time we get rid of all of these methods that insurance companies use.
Well, I can just say, if I were in Arkansas and I were paying 50% more for the exact same health care plan than one of my male cohorts, I would throw a fit. Judy Waxman, Vice President of the National Women's Law Center, thanks so much for joining us.
Other big medical story we learned about over the weekend. On Friday, the Obama administration declared a state of emergency, calling the H1N1 influenza outbreak constituted a national emergency. Dr. Peter Hotez joins us now. He's a distinguished research professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Tropical Medicine at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He joins us from Bethesda. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, it seemed curious to me the timing of this declaration of emergency, right as the reports were surfacing that there was a serious shortfall in the amount of H1N1 vaccine. Apparently, instead of 13 million, more like 3 million, or 120 million, more like 13 million doses were available on the schedule that we had been promised. Do you think there's anything curious about the timing there?
No, I think the two are unrelated. I think, you know, the way to think about this emergency declaration is, I think it was reported in the Washington Post a couple of days ago, that this is like getting the snow plows and the salt ready in case of a winter storm. It's to just optimize flexibility for hospitals to provide triage, to provide makeshift off-site units such as at armories or tents if necessary, and to possibly waive some privacy rules. So this is I would think about this as a kind of an administrative mechanism to make things easier. That doesn't mean that the problem with vaccine is not real. It's just that those two events are not related.
All right, then let me just ask an epidemiological question. If there is a delay in getting vaccine, doesn't a declaration of national emergency, for all the sort of administrative advantages it grants to healthcare providers, doesn't it increase the demand, in a sense, complicate the shortfall, because more people are going to want to stand in these lines, more people are going to get a little bit desperate thinking that it's an emergency, and if they're not well informed, it's going to create a worse situation?
Well, possibly, but you know, I think the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration have been very consistent with, and the Health and Human Services have been very consistent with, who should get vaccinated. I mean, there's a cohort of 159 million people that need to get vaccinated first and foremost, starting with pregnant women, parents of infants less than 6 months of age, children and young adults between 6 months and 24 years, and then, of course, people who are immunocompromised for whatever reason, whether it's medicines they're on, et cetera. I mean, the problem that we're really facing is we have what I like to call the perfect storm that has created shortfalls in vaccines. And one of the issues is most of our vaccines, let's face it, is made offshore. So we don't make them in the country.
Well, that plus the technology comes from many decades ago. Explain how you need a lot of eggs to make a lot of vaccine, and that there's really no way to hurry that process up.
Well, so the technology was developed at the first part of the 20th century, so it really is an ancient technology. Literally, what you do is take embryonated eggs and you inoculate them with virus, and what you hope and expect is that the virus will grow in eggs, and it usually does. The problem is sometimes the yield, the amount of virus you can get out of an egg, is more or less depending on this, on the particular strain of viruses. So in the past, where you might get 3 or 4 doses of influenza vaccine out of a single egg, now you'll get maybe a 1.5 dose for this particular strain.
My understanding that if you try to increase the yield, you run the risk of actually making virus powerful enough to give people the flu, right?
Well, not so much that. I mean, the strain is carefully attenuated. I mean, there are ways you can extend the amount of virus you use, and this is what they're doing in Canada and also in Europe, which they're adding what's called an adjuvant to the vaccine so they can use less of the virus and create the same type of immune response. And so we made an executive decision in this country not to go with adjuvanted vaccine.
Adjuvanted vaccine. Learn something every day on this program. We're living with the consequences of it. Dr. Peter Hotez is a distinguished research professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Tropical Medicine at George Washington University, talking about the implications of an Obama-declared national emergency regarding H1N1 influenza. You know, I was surprised to learn that this whole state of emergency thing actually involves federal regulations of emergency rooms. I didn't realize that a hospital needed the feds to tell them to move people outside into a tent.
Well, they need the permission to, and whether the hospital wants to or not, they need to have permission.
I guess that's strange to me. I'm surprised by that.
Well, last week we asked about the vaccine, but we asked people not about hospital restrictions, but whether or not they're going to get the vaccine or whether they're concerned about it. And someone called in to our website, thetakeaway.org, and said, "I'm quite nervous as my 3-month-old cannot have the vaccine, but my husband, I, and my mother in law who are primary caregivers can't get it either. I'm scared to death I'm going to bring this home from work. So frustrating. Call the pediatrician. Nope, we can't vaccinate adults. Call the OBGYN. Nope, you're not pregnant. Where do I get on the bleeping list? We're considered priority group 2, so who knows when it'll finally get to us and how we'll find out how to get it."
Is that a medical term, bleeping list?
That's a technical term.
Doc, I'd like to get on the bleeping list.
There's the
my wife's on list number 1, being pregnant, and they keep delaying.
She hasn't been vaccinated yet.
She hasn't been vaccinated. They're saying weeks away.
Let us know what you think. TheTakeaway.org. You can also call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and let us know your story about the vaccine or anything else you hear on the show.
Hey, you want that to go?
And for some takeouts on stories we're following this week, we want you to stay on top of healthcare, of course, the public option. Todd Zwillick joins us, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, it was once dead. Now it seems to be alive. As someone described on the program earlier this morning, the Democrats have developed a backbone on the public option. How does it look at this point?
Well, they have developed a backbone, I guess, but mixed signals, especially coming out of the House. On Friday morning, John, there were reports that Speaker Nancy Pelosi has realized that she doesn't have the votes for the so-called robust public option based on Medicare, the one the liberals really want, and that she was abandoning that in favor of sort of a what a Democrat anyway would describe as a weaker public option.
But something closer to the Senate bill.
Well, they wanted the Democrats in the House wanted to bat that away really quickly. So they sort of called a news conference and made sure that not only the speaker was there, but the rest of the Democratic leadership, including the whip, James Clyburn of South Carolina, who's the man who's responsible for rounding up every single head, every single vote for any one of these positions. And he was asked, Mr. Clyburn, you know, what is the texture of this? How is it going as you try to get members to sign on to a public option? Tell us what that's like. Here's what he said.
Well, thank you so much for allowing me to publicly discuss my anxieties.
Anxieties.
It's nice you
can
help him out with that there, Tom. Yeah.
Anxieties is right as they try to find out which version of the public option to go with. Now, Nancy Pelosi was asked the question, have you abandoned the robust public option? And she said, no, absolutely not. The reports aren't true. We're still going for it. But then at the same time, she started to make a justification for going for a different version of the public option, one based on so-called negotiated rates. And again, the only difference between those is one is based on Medicare. The other is, yes, there's a public option, but you have to negotiate the same way private insurance negotiates. It's kind of like a level playing field. So on the one hand, the speaker says, no, we haven't given up. And on the other hand, she says this.
This is about the end game now. It's not necessarily about, because there's no philosophical difference between the robust public option and negotiated rates. It's just a difference in money.
End
no
game.
Philosophical
right.
difference.
End game. So, I don't believe it for a minute.
Right,
so takeaways, Washington correspondent reporting from Washington on the public option. End game? I don't think so.
Well, now let's talk about the end game, maybe for huge, gigantic banks. Dan Gross is joining us now. He's a columnist for Slate and Newsweek, filling in for Louis Storage this morning. Dan, we're hearing all about banks being too big to fail and us the Obama administration maybe dismantling them or respecting a bill today. Do we know what's going to be in it?
Well, the word is that Barney Frank, who is the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, may be introducing legislation this week to deal with institutions that are too big to fail. One way of thinking about it is that in the future, the hope is that we will eat these giant banks before they eat us. And the idea is to set up what they're calling a sort of living will. That is to say, there was no regime or no process, no protocol for dealing with the failure of gigantic institutions that, you know, the FDIC's deposit fund couldn't handle, companies like Citigroup and Bank of America.
So how are they going to do it? Are they going to split off the trading from the consumer products? How are they going to split these things up?
Well, that is the devil, of course, is always in the details. I think the main thing to look for is forcing companies that are that big to put more money aside, to hold greater reserves. The idea being, you know, we have these standards. If you're a bank, you have to hold $1 in reserves for every, you know, $10 or $15 you have in loans outstanding. And, you know, that works well for a small bank because if they fail, the FDIC can handle it. Doesn't work as well for something like Citigroup. So one of the things we're talking about is requiring them to hold more money. That has kind of two functions. One is, A, they will have more money so that they are less likely to fail, but that also provides an incentive for banks not to get too big. In other words, if you change the regulations, you change the structure, I think the idea is that you provide them with reasons why they shouldn't get that big, financial reasons why they shouldn't get that big.
Because they need all the money to back it up, right?
So the government won't be in the business of saying, you get smaller.
Okay, so Dan, one of the questions we're asking all of our listeners today is, are you living without a credit card? Have you ever thought about living without a credit card? And what would it take to get you to give up your plastic? So do you live without credit, Dan?
No. Everybody has credit.
In a word, no.
And what would it take? Would you ever consider living without a credit card?
Well, if my, you know, company would just pay for
all my expenses instead of having me have a company-issued credit card, maybe I wouldn't need one.
So, Slate and Newsweek, you could have Dan give up his plastic if you just didn't make him cover his own travel expenses. Thanks so much, Dan Gross.
Thank you.
I'm tempted to say help Dan Gross at 8778 my take. But Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, has our next takeout. Boy, the Yankees clinch their place in the World Series in Game 6 last night. They beat the California Angels 5-2. By my calculation, they spent $200 million just this year alone. 40 World Series for the Yankees, 26 championships. Is this a good business model, Ibrahim?
I talked to my dad, and I was like, Daddy, are you watching the game? And he was like, I can't watch the game. It's too stressful. And I think that that's the case for a lot of Yankees fans, because we did put a lot into this, and now finally, after 6 years, we got the result we wanted.
And I guess the question is, are the Yankees favored going up against the Philadelphia Phillies on Wednesday night, or what would you say?
I think most observers say that they have a better team overall, but it won't be the kind of series where it's like 1- and 2-run games. It's going to be like 8-6, 9-6, 10-7.
A lot of bats,
a lot of hitters. That's the challenge that you have. You have good starting pitching, and you have weaker bullpens in both of these teams.
C.C. Sabathia was the MVP of the American League Championship Series, the ace pitcher for the Yankees. I guess Alex Rodriguez is maybe hoping he'll be the MVP in the World Series if Ryan Howard doesn't beat him.
That's true. The one person you could give a nod to for the Angels was a guy named Jeff Mathis. Mathis was pretty much lights out. Every time he was at the plate for the Angels, he hit a double or a triple. He drove in runs. He was the catcher, and he didn't let a lot of balls go past him. So you got to give a nod to Jeff Mathis.
And the you know, Angels really thought this was going to be a year for them, and it's a real heartbreak for them.
Definitely, in light of what happened with the tragedy of Nick Adenhart in the beginning of the year.
Indeed.
So we hope that folks remember him at the end of the season, just because his untimely demise and early in the season gave them the energy to move forward.
Angels will be back, that's for sure. Let's talk football in the brief seconds that we have. There are three teams undefeated at this stage of the season. That's a first for the NFL.
I think what's really happening right now is that in the AFC, the picture is really difficult. In the Colts, you have
undefeated.
You have the Pittsburgh Steelers, who are playing like they're undefeated
and beat an undefeated team yesterday.
Correct.
The Minnesota Vikings.
And now the Vikings' demise means that there's only one team left in NFC, and that's the New Orleans Saints, who are dangerous.
And they look fantastic. Drew Brees has got to be the best football player in the NFL.
And
right
I'm
now.
A little annoyed right now. He is the best football player in the NFL. I'm a little annoyed.
The Dolphins did not win.
Exactly.
I knew they wouldn't.
Sorry.
I knew it.
Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor and part-time bookie for Celeste Headley. Thank you very much.
Hey, I get $15 off this.
Coming up, assessing the potential of a relationship between Iran and nuclear inspectors as we learn more about Iran. That's in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Wall Street is open and the rally is sort of surging a little bit. The futures trading suggested a positive opening, and that's what we have. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says it's unfortunate that the H1N1 vaccine is not widely available. But speaking on national television this morning, she says it eventually will be available. Overseas, the Taliban is claiming responsibility for a series of helicopter crashes in Afghanistan that killed 14 Americans. But NATO spokesman Colonel Wayne Shanks denies those claims.
Now, in both of these incidents, we do not believe that enemy action was responsible for that. We're still looking into it to see what actually happened, but we don't believe that it was due to any enemy fire.
Both military and civilian personnel were among those killed. Meanwhile, President Obama will discuss strategy in Afghanistan once again this morning with his national security advisors.
In Iraq, burials are underway after twin suicide attacks killed more than 150 over the weekend. Iraqi security forces blocked the streets around the capital today. Back in the U.S., a Jordanian man accused of trying to blow up a Dallas skyscraper is expected in court today. Investigators say the 19-year-old parked a truck with what he thought was a bomb in a garage under a 60-story building. At the box office this weekend, it was a paranormal horror weekend.
Something's here. I feel it breathing on me.
Footsteps in, but there's no footsteps out.
Oh, God,
that low-budget horror flick took the top spot at the box office, earned $22 million.
Paranormal Activity.
Yep, another chiller. Saw 6 came in second. Those are some of the news stories you're following this morning.
So lots of details coming out of Iran regarding its nuclear program, and we've been following them over the last several weeks. The Iranian government has been quoted as saying that it may agree to send abroad a part of its existing stock of low-enriched uranium for further processing. Also, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, inspected a former secret facility in the city of Qom. The question is, will inspectors be allowed easy access to all of Iran's nuclear programs? To find out, we're talking to Scott Ritter, former chief weapons inspector for the United Nations Special Commission in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. And John Line, BBC Tehran correspondent, joined us earlier this morning from London. I asked John if the alleged deal between the IAEA and Iran is connected to the recent inspection of Qom.
Well, to some extent they're related because, of course, this plant in Qom was revealed. It seems like the Iranians decided they had to announce it because they realized that Western intelligence were onto it. So they were rumbled. I think that would be the Western analysis anyway. Of course, Iran would deny it. And as a result, we then saw Iran in a bit more of a cooperative mood. They were talking more cooperatively when they came to this first new round of talks in Geneva at the beginning of October. And in those talks, the West believes Iran agreed to this deal under which it ships out its stocks of enriched uranium, the stuff that potentially could be used to make a bomb. And this is turned into new fuel for this research reactor. So in other words, Iran's perhaps slightly more cooperative mood seems to have been inspired by the fact that they were caught off their guard. However, of course, it's not so simple now when we're not quite clear how cooperative Iran is now being.
Sure. Well, to attempt to assess that, Scott Ritter joins us, former chief weapons inspector for the United Nations Special Commission in Iraq back in the 1990s. Scott Ritter, you know, as we saw in Iraq, the inspection regime there became a political circus where it was very difficult for people on the outside to know what was going on or if they were deliberately either overemphasizing or de-emphasizing the nuclear program in Iraq. Reality just went out of the window. How do you characterize the challenges facing IAEA inspectors in Iran at this point?
Well, first of all, the IAEA inspectors in Iran are there to do a technical job, to basically implement the safeguards agreement between the International Atomic Energy Agency and Iran. It's pretty much a straightforward task. It's complicated by the politics that get woven over the top of it that are brought on by nations that aren't so much concerned about the non-proliferation treaty as they are concerned about Iran. There's an anti-Iran policy in place in the United States and elsewhere. Regardless of what President Obama says about the need to engage, he inherited a policy objective of regime change, and many aspects of that policy are in place. And this is what
indeed, Scott Ritter,
the task.
The as you say, the Turkish government has actually criticized as recently as this morning that apparent double standard. Do you think that the IAEA is forced to treat Iran differently from other nations because of political actors like the U.S. government?
Absolutely. I mean, the bottom line is we have in place today a number of Security Council resolutions that weren't brought about by IAEA intervention, but rather pressure by the United States to create a new set of standards because, frankly speaking, Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty allows Iran the right to enrich uranium. It also allows Iran the right to purchase uranium abroad for its reactors. But the fact is Iran is not allowed to function as a member of a functioning member of the IAEA because of this double standard, and it complicates everything. Look, we have inspectors on the ground in Iran looking at what is pretty much an empty facility. And yet, take a look at the hype that takes place around this empty facility. It's going to be under full monitoring. The world will know exactly what's going to happen step by step by step. And yet, people talk about a secret nuclear weapons facility or program derived from this very facility. It's absurd in the extreme.
But Scott Ritter, I think part of the skepticism that comes there on people's part is saying, how can you possibly know that you've seen everything at this facility? How can you possibly know the Iranians didn't move some things out of the way in the weeks they had to prepare for this visit? How do you know the extent of the activities on the parts of the Iranians?
Well, see, that now we bring in we bring in the earlier question in relation to Iraq. How do you prove a negative? You know, people can sit back right now and say just about anything they want about the Iranian program. They can make it up. In fact, there's been allegations that much of the information that's out there today about an Iranian nuclear weapons program is fabricated by opposition elements opposed to the theocracy in Tehran. And so you throw something out there, and now it's up to the Iranians to prove that these allegations aren't true. Before one talks about movement of material, there must be evidence that material was moved. You can't speak hypothetically. That's
how Understood.
The inspection program works.
Okay, Scott Ritter, hold on there for a second. I mean, we don't have much time, but John Lyne, is there an innocent before proven guilty or a guilty before proven innocent burden on the IAEA's part when they inspect a nation like Iran?
The problem about this is that the key part of this program, the uranium enrichment, doesn't currently have a civilian purpose because Iran doesn't have a reactor it can use that enriched uranium in. Yes, one is being built at Bushehr, but the Russians not only are supplying the enriched uranium, they would not allow the uranium that's been enriched to be used in it.
Great point, John Lyne. Great point. Let's put it to Scott Ritter. I mean, are you allowed to have enriched uranium if you don't have a reactor to use it in, Scott Ritter?
Look, when you're speaking Quickly. About an atomic energy program, you're talking not just about reactors, but the ability to fuel the reactors throughout the life of the reactors.
That was Scott Ritter, former chief weapons inspector for the UN in Iraq, and John Lyne, BBC Tehran correspondent, joined us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. The New England Patriots were in London over the weekend. They blew out the Tampa Bay Buccaneers 35-7. We wanted to see what it was like for the British fans of the NFL there. So we talked to the BBC's Martin Goff, who was at the game. Good morning, Martin. So a big tradition in the United States is that if you go to see a football game, you tailgate like in the parking lot or somewhere else. Here's one of the U.S. fans outside of Wembley Stadium.
It's different because in the States, you're in a parking lot. It's more of an atmosphere where you can mingle more with people. But here, it's more of like a general concert, you know, a general admission concert.
This one's really designed to mingle with everybody. Right. So they're both fun, but we're still used to the United States way of tailgating.
So what was it like there? Was it a concert where people just grabbed their tickets and everyone wandered in together?
Yeah, it was like the NFL organized an official tailgate party, so fun was a little bit prescribed there. We don't have the same sort of culture of getting together around cars and having barbecues, so the NFL's kind of brought it over and officially put it in place. But there was a stage there with cheerleaders doing routines, there was music, there were lots of stalls with beer and food. So there was a decent pre-match atmosphere. I got there about 2.5 hours before game kicked off. A decent pre-match atmosphere, but it wasn't sort of quite as spontaneous.
Since you mentioned cheerleaders, there was an accusation that the cheerleaders were going to be showing a little bit too much of their skin.
Apparently there was some upset last year because of the cheerleaders and English people being offended by the amount of flesh on show.
Don't be silly. I'll say more flesh.
So that's what you're going to be looking out for.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah.
Not a problem, apparently.
No people offended by the scantily clad cheerleaders.
I have to say, it was a little bit of a surprise that people had been offended. I'm not sure who those people were. Most people are
Parliament,
House
of Lords.
Most people appreciate the cheerleaders, and that's one of the highlights for
they appreciate
for people
the
who don't know the game too
appreciation,
much.
Appreciation, that's what we call it.
I have to say, I was a little bit worried for the Tampa Bay cheerleaders. They're obviously used to the Florida weather, and they turned up in London. It was getting a little bit chilly as it got past sort of 6 o'clock in the evening, and they weren't wearing too much to keep them warm, I'm afraid.
I'm glad your concern is overwhelming there, Martin. One last thing. Does tailgate cuisine hold the potential of improving the reputation of cuisine in London and in the UK?
Well, everybody likes their burgers and fries anyway. I don't think we're going to get much change there. There was all the sort of usual American things on offer. There was a fish and chips stand there.
Nice.
There was a British pork roast. But I only found one set of fans who were doing a traditional tailgate, like out of the tailgate of their car.
Were they British?
British fans. They'd been to a game in the States, so they knew how it worked. But they didn't have a barbecue. I think probably Wembley officials would get a little bit worried about open fires in the car park.
Very quickly, Martin, is this from these fans approaching this like, oh, let's go and do this American thing, experience an American Sunday?
Yes, it's very much like that. There's a lot of sort of Americanophiles, if you will. A lot of people who'd really like to be going to games in the States, but can't get there. So they get into the real American feel of it.
Thanks. Martin Goff is our partner with the BBC. He joined us from London. Did you hear he said pork roast?
I think, yeah, well, I wonder if there are any bangers at the tailgate parties, too. You know, I just think the NFL was deliberately mean. The Patriots...
I think that's splitting hairs.
Patriots, they actually have like a Boston Tea Party.
Come on.
They should have picked, I don't know. What team would you have done? The Saints, I suppose.
You could do the, yeah, but that would be French.
The Anglicans.
That would be like Francophones.
Right. The Little Rock Anglicans.
That'd they be couldn't take the team. Cleveland Indians.
Yeah, that's interesting. They were allies in the war.
Some of them.
John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we're going to talk about how you can live without credit. Well, actually, live without a credit card. You can probably get by without ever being in debt at all. It would be difficult.
I guess you could.
What are the challenges? First, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. In Afghanistan, NATO is denying Taliban claims it was involved in helicopter crashes that killed 14 Americans today. NATO says in one of the incidents, two helicopters collided. Breaking news from the Associated Press, they report from Pakistan that 11 Revolutionary Guards from Iran have been arrested after crossing into Pakistan from Iranian territory.
The head of the Health and Human Services says it's unfortunate that the H1N1 vaccine is not widely available, but it will be soon. And looking ahead, it's set the Yankees will face the Phillies in the World Series on Wednesday. Those are some of the news stories we're watching.
I think the American public should go credit-free one day a month. Say, that's it, we're not using our credit card. And show these big companies what it'll feel like if we start rejecting them.
Oh, yeah, that'll show them. That was just one of the many responses we got last week on our story about credit card companies' power over consumers. The power of plastic, as I recall anyway, supposed to make consumers unafraid of the retail world, to feel like they could go out and spend and not worry. But people end up fearing their credit cards and the dependence that credit cards engenders in people's spending habits. And we're asking you about how to live without a credit card. What would you have to do to live without a credit card? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And to help us figure all of this out, of course, Takeaway correspondent Beth Koblenner joins us to talk more about life without plastic. And first, let's begin, Beth, and good morning.
Good morning.
Let's distinguish between people who have voluntarily given up credit cards and their sacrifices, and we want to talk about those, with people who don't even have the option to have a credit card to begin with. How many people are in those various groups, if we can estimate?
Right. There are about 25 million people who don't have credit at all, who don't have any credit cards, any credit at all. Then there are about 35 more million people who have not such much credit, not too much credit. So there are about 60 million people who are walking around without a credit card, which is a large number.
Well, I was just going to say, but there's also the different group like myself who have credit. I mean, I have a mortgage and I have a car loan, but I do not want to carry credit cards.
Credit cards. Well, herein lies the interesting story that we're seeing. There is a revolt going on. People are mad as hell, and they're not going to take it anymore when it comes to credit cards.
And these are people with good credit who
people
are choosing voluntarily to get out of it.
Choosing because, first of all, if you have good credit these days, that's no guarantee you're not going to be paying higher fees. You know, now banks are announcing that even if you never are late ever, if you pay off your bill in full each month, they're still going to possibly charge you a fee.
Or cancel your account.
People are very annoyed.
People like Joel Westendorf, for instance, on the line from Los Angeles, California.
Yeah.
Joel, good morning.
Good morning.
And Andrea Hermit on the line from Atlanta, Georgia. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
So, Joel, let me begin with you. How mad are you, and how much does anger motivate your decision to be credit card free?
Not too much. I haven't ever had a credit card, so
mellow guy.
I hear horror stories, so sometimes I'm glad that I've avoided it.
And sometimes do you regret it? Do you encounter some sort of limitation that makes you pretty annoyed?
I wouldn't say annoyed, but just like, you know, I have to save for things instead of, you know, buying them outright. So
I mean, what a concept, you know?
Yes. And Joel, we want to distinguish. You're not living in a cabin somewhere in a yurt outside of Los Angeles, right?
Yurt.
All right, great. Andrea, what is your story of being credit card free, and how angry did you get before you made the decision?
Well, I can't say I got angry. You know, just like most Americans, we went through a period of unemployment about 4 or 5 years ago. And so, of course, we maxed out our credit cards. And so they were maxed, and we were pushed to the wall and we had to use cash. So after about a year or so, we had credit back, you know, we had money back, and I'm looking at these cards going, why in the world would I use this? I haven't had to use it in a year and a half.
So that's sort of recession-enforced behavior that actually turns out to look like a really, really good deal. Here's another story from someone from New Jersey.
It's really difficult. I've always had to live from hand to mouth, and when a big expense comes up, you have no recourse but to seek out either private financing or family and friends that can help. When you have a limited income and you're never sure when you're going to be able to pay money back, living with a credit card is just, it's just beyond my reach.
Now, Beth, I can't tell there if she's really, really worried about having an expense and not being able to pay for it and not having the money on hand to do it, or if she just doesn't want to get into the whole business of credit cards at all.
I think I've seen it cut down to two, and there are two people who spoke before are the perfect examples. In one case, some people just shy away from the whole thing. You hear about it. It sounds like such a nightmare that I want to get involved. That's a very small percentage of people. But most Americans have gotten really deep. The average American household, although they have been paying down their debts, they still have $7,900 in credit card debt. That's the average American household. So they're still carrying a lot of credit card debt, but they're trying to figure out ways of not using the credit card to buy the couch that they want. Instead, it's a new concept, but you save up money for things.
All right. Well, Donna from New Jersey, I think, raises a fear that a lot of people have if they are anticipating this sort of credit card-free world. Andrea Hermit in Atlanta, Georgia, if your roof caved in tomorrow or, God forbid, one of your relatives had a serious medical setback, how would you deal with that if you don't have a credit card and can't, like, make the expense right away?
I generally have money in the bank for that kind of thing. Otherwise, I guess I would go to an older relative and ask. But my roof is caving in as we speak.
Whoops.
You know, we don't play around with stuff like that. We saw a drip. We called the insurance company. It's being taken care of.
All right, Joel, how about you? How do you deal with expenses that are unexpected that would require you to pull cash?
Kind of the same story. Maybe talk to an older relative or... I do keep some savings for rainy days, so.
Literally.
On behalf of Andrea and Joel, I would like to, you know, argue the characterization that people who live without credit are some kind of unibomber living in a yurt outside Los Angeles. Because, you know, it's not like I'm making a huge amount of money. I've been a single mother for 11 years. I've been living paycheck to paycheck for a long time, and I still don't carry credit cards. And when bills have had come up with no older relatives for me to turn to, I've still handled them.
Joel's a mainstream guy. You're mainstream.
Look at this conversation we're having. We feel like somebody who doesn't have credit card debt, what's a little wrong with you? And when I've gone around the country, I've had young people tell me that their peers say, you're not using credit cards? What's wrong with you?
Right.
Is there a moral dimension to all this? You know, you're supposed to be debt-free and that...
Well, I'd say it's the opposite. I mean, I think that was the case, you know, for our parents and grandparents' generation. And I think that notion that you're supposed to be living debt-free hasn't really been around for such a long time. I think most people haven't even thought about that. People in their 20s and 30s, they don't even think about the concept of, oh, you mean I wouldn't buy something? Well, how would I get those shoes?
To buy it?
So it's immoral to not shop, I guess.
Exactly. It doesn't even sort of hit the conscience. You know, it doesn't seem like it's possible. So I think this is a very healthy thing. You know, I think there's nothing evil about credit cards. If you can handle it and you pay it off in full each month, you are building up your credit record. But there's a myth that you have to have a credit card to have a credit history, and that's not the case. If you're paying off a car loan regularly or a student loan regularly or a mortgage loan regularly, that is also building a credit history. So you want to know the rules. A lot of these myths are flying around, and I think it's like some little blogger at Visa or something. I don't know who. You know, I'm just kidding.
Well, Joel,
somebody's passing this stuff around.
Joel is proof. Joel Westendorf in Los Angeles, California, is proof that the myth that you have to have a credit card doesn't really apply. Joel, good luck to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Andrea Hermit, some final advice for people who are wanting to give up their credit cards?
Well, just don't get involved in the first place. I mean, it's just very easy if you think about it. I want to go to California for 2 weeks. You know, I can keep living as normal using my credit cards, go to California, run up $2,000 in debt, come back home and worry about it. Or I can plan 2 months ahead save up a few thousand dollars, and that's exactly what I do every summer. Work a little bit harder because I freelance, right? Save up $2,000, $3,000. Go to California, have a very good time.
And no worries.
You know, eat a little bit less for lunch, maybe.
Yeah.
Right.
And come home debt-free.
Nice. And you come home when the money runs out. Andrea Hermit, thanks so much for joining us from Atlanta. As always, Beth Koblinder, takeaway contributor on all these sorts of matters. Thanks, Beth, for busting some more myths.
So what's your story? Do you live life without a credit card? Would you want to? And what would it take to make you do it? Zazel emails us, I listen to my father's ever-present voice. If you can't pay cash, you can't afford it. As for car rentals, I can rent locally with a refundable cash deposit, no credit card for years, and I get along just fine. Liz says, for years I lived without a credit card, never even applied for one because I saw a slippery slope just waiting for me there. Then I went to buy a new car, and since I had no credit history, I had to have a cosigner. So how do I get around that?
Slippery
8778 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. You're not helping
Halloween.
The seriousness slope. Of this conversation, John.
Well, it's serious, of course. It's serious to a point. It's slippery slope. Avoid the slippery slopes. All slippery slopes. No slippery slopes on this show. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.